Have you ever gone someplace and when you arrived there, it was nothing like what you had expected? Or perhaps you attended some sort of social function and when you got there, you were surprised because things were different from your expectations? I mean, you didn't even realize it was a costume party. Everybody else is dressed up and you show up and it feels very awkward because you weren't ready for what you actually encountered. I wonder sometimes, not the costume thing, but I wonder sometimes if that's not the way people feel when they come here and they visit with us. Have you given any thought to the fact that we come here and we are very familiar with what we're going to do each Sunday or each Wednesday? We are comfortable with the order of our worship and the kind of worship that we engage in, but that others come and they visit with us, never perhaps ever having worshiped in an assembly of members of the Church of Christ, and what seems very familiar to us may seem very strange to them. After all, we have no choir. Many churches do. We have no worship leader, pastor, priest, preacher, but worship leader is the idea in special garb. A lot of churches do. There are special garments that are worn by the priest or the pastor. And we have no instrumental music, which most churches do. The difference that probably surprises most folks the most is that, the absence of instrumental music in our worship. Probably because instrumental music is so commonly used in the worship of religious groups. Most groups have some kind of instrumental music. We do not. And that probably seems very strange to people who visit with us. And it's entirely natural, I believe, for people to question what seems strange to them. And that's not necessarily an indication that they don't wish to serve God acceptably. And I think we need to approach it that way. In fact, their very questioning of why we're doing what we're doing may very well be an indication of their desire to serve God according to the divine will. Otherwise, they would just assume, well, if that's the way you guys do it, but other people do it another way, don't worry about it. It doesn't make any difference. If they want to know why we're doing what we're doing, what the reason for the absence of instrumental music is, it may very well be because they're concerned about exactly that, worshiping God according to His will. But some might reason, if so many groups are using instrumental music in their worship, surely there's got to be some biblical basis for that practice. How could so many religious people be off base on this business of music in worship? Well, this evening I want to talk about instrumental music in worship. And I suspect that for many of you, I'm not going to say things that are new to you. It may simply be a review, but perhaps we can, in that review, help clarify things or make it easier for us to share some of this information with others that we're trying to teach. Some of this information may be new to some of you, and it may be helpful to you as we try to answer the reason for the fact that we don't use instrumental music in worship. And so I want to accomplish three things this evening, as time will permit. Hopefully we'll get to all three of these. I want to emphasize the need for divine authority for the things that we do in our worship. That's where we're going to start. But we need to look at some of the arguments that are made for instrumental music in worship. And then if time permits, I want to note the introduction of instrumental music in worship. That's a fair question, isn't it? If instrumental music is not authorized in the New Testament, then why is it so commonly used in religious groups? And hopefully we'll have a few moments to at least suggest the reason for that. But let's begin this evening by talking about the question of whether we use instrumental music and what's germane to that question. There are several things that sometimes people get hung up on that I want to suggest are really unrelated to this question. For instance, the question of whether we like or dislike instrumental music is not the issue. I like instrumental music. I like instrumental music of the classics. I like a variety of kinds of music, instrumental and vocal, but our like or dislike of instrumental music isn't the point. Nor is it our talent or lack of talent in the playing of instruments. I got a kick. I was driving down Nick Davis just recently. It's been within the last month or so. And there was a sign there on the church's, there was a church sign there. And on the church sign it said, pianist needed. So can you just go in regardless of who you are and you apply and you become the person who plays the piano for the worship services? A lot of churches do that. I've heard on numerous occasions in my time of preaching where churches actually hire people to play the piano who are not members of that church. In fact, in some cases, they're not members of any church. They just need somebody to play piano. Is that why we don't have a piano? Because the elders are too cheap? Too cheap to hire somebody? No, that's not it at all. That's really unrelated. And it's not a matter of funds for an organ or a piano or other instruments. I'm sure we could find something. If that was really what we needed to do or wanted to do, those are all unrelated things. No, in fact, the real issue is whether instrumental music is authorized in the Scriptures for our use in worship. Here's the question. Will God accept whatever we offer Him in worship? And I want to suggest to you a couple of examples that you are probably quite familiar with. The first one has to do with Cain and Abel. You recall, I think, very well the story in Genesis, the fourth chapter, where God apparently had given instructions to Cain and Abel, the sons of Adam and Eve, that they were to offer sacrifice. Cain's sacrifice was unacceptable. Abel's sacrifice was accepted by God, and it was that difference that eventually led to the murder of Abel. Cain was envious of his brother and angry, and he kills his brother Abel. But here's my point. Two people offer worship to God, and God didn't accept just whatever each of them offered. Now we could go to the book of Hebrews, or perhaps we could talk about the story from Genesis, the fourth chapter, and try to determine why it was that Cain's offering wasn't accepted. That's not my point. My point is simply, it wasn't accepted for whatever reason. Because it answers this question, will God accept whatever man offers? And the obvious answer is no. And so then we have to talk about in our worship what it is that God wants from us. We may never be able to determine exactly what happened with Cain and Abel. We have some ideas, I suspect. But more importantly, what does God demand of us? And this question has already been answered once. But it's answered again in Leviticus, the 10th chapter, in the passage that John read about Nadab and Abihu. You remember they were the sons of Aaron, and they go into the tabernacle, and they offer, as the New King James Version says, profane fire. Fire that wasn't sanctified. Fire that hadn't been set apart for the purpose for which they were using it, and that is to offer worship to God. And God answered the question, will He accept just whatever man offers? Even Nadab and Abihu, who are sons of Aaron, who are going in, they're trying to worship, or at least that's their apparent intention, is to go into the tabernacle and worship, and God struck them dead. Fire from heaven consumed them, killed them, and they haul their bodies out. The question is answered. God doesn't accept just whatever man offers. And so the real issue, the question of instrumental music, is not any of those other things about money or talent or like or not like. The real issue is it authorized by God? And we don't want to get away from that issue. Because there are a lot of emotional arguments we could talk about, and I played with the idea, no pun intended, I considered the possibility of looking at some of the emotional arguments that sometimes people use to defend instrumental music. But really the question is it authorized by God? And so instead, what I would like to do is I'd like to talk first of all about the general purpose of worship, and then I want to look at some of the arguments that are made from a scriptural standpoint in defense of instrumental music. Well, let's talk about the purpose of worship. The answer to the question, will God accept just whatever man decides to offer in the way of worship, is really has to do with the nature of worship, and that is that worship is designed to express respect and reverence for God. How is it that we could express reverence for God if we are at the same time ignoring His instructions for worship? Your parents know that there's no respect shown to you by your children If you command them to do something, you tell them this is the way to do it, and they just say, well, I'm going to do it my own way. They are not respecting you, even if in some way they are trying to help you. You gave them instructions, and they disregarded your instructions. They do not honor you when they do that. And that was the reason Jesus said that the Pharisees' worship was vain. These people draw near to me with their mouth and honor me with their lips, but their heart is far from me, and in vain they worship me, teaching as doctrines the commandments of men. Jesus says it's not just uttering things, it's not just this business of offering worship. Vain worship takes place when people substitute the commandments of men for the doctrines and the teachings of God. So the issue is not just that we're trying to worship, but are we doing it according to the instructions that God has set forth? Well, let's spend a few moments talking about some arguments that are frequently used to defend instrumental music in worship by Christians. One of the most common arguments, obviously, is that it was used in worship in Old Testament times. Now, by Old Testament times, most people are referring to the practice of the Israelites in their worship to God. And it is certainly undeniable that the Israelites did, in fact, worship God using instrumental music in that worship. In fact, in 1 Chronicles, the 25th chapter, we even have record of where David appointed musicians for service in that worship. One of the things we need to remember is that Israel lived under the Mosaic law, a law which, frankly, was not given to men in general, but only to Israel. So when we look at the Old Testament, despite all the things that we can learn about God and His nature and worship and sin and sacrifice, etc., we do have to understand that we're looking at a specific case. And that is, we're looking at the history of God's people, for the most part, Israel, their history, and they were under a covenant that was specifically given to them and only to them. Now, others could proselyte. They could become Jews by being circumcised. They could essentially be grafted into the nation. But the Mosaic covenant was not given to men in general. So it's difficult for us then to take things that are provisions of that old law and then apply them to all men in general. But even more important, the Mosaic law, whether it was given to Israel or to all men in general, was taken away at the death of Jesus. And there are several passages that we could look at to suggest that truth, but I'm going to look at two, and I think these are probably in many ways the most convincing or the clearest to see. In Colossians 2 and Ephesians 2, Paul writes that very thing. In Colossians 2, verses 13 and 14, he writes to them, "And you, being dead in your trespasses and the uncircumcision of your flesh, he has made alive together with him, having forgiven you all trespasses, having wiped out the handwriting of requirements that was against us, which was contrary to us, and he has taken it out of the way, having nailed it to the cross." What was it that was nailed to the cross? Well, it wasn't our sins, it was the law that was against us. In Colossians, the second chapter, if we were to go a little bit further down into the text, and I didn't put this on the chart, but it might be good for us to note this just very quickly. In Colossians 2, look at the rest of the passage following verses 13 and 14. The Apostle Paul says, then in verse 15, "Having disarmed principalities and powers, he made a public spectacle of them, triumphing over them in it." Now here's the conclusion of verse 16 and 17. "So, let no one judge you in food, or in drink, or regarding a festival, or a new moon, or Sabbaths, which are a shadow of things to come, but the substance is of Christ." Paul says that because Christ has taken this handwriting of requirements that was against us, having nailed it to the cross, because of that, then nobody is able then to judge us with respect to things that were essentially requirements of the law. Food and drink and festivals and Sabbaths. All of those things, he says, are a shadow of the things to come. That's similar language to the book of Hebrews. And so it's clear that in the context here, Paul is talking about the taking away of the Mosaic law. In Ephesians 2, verses 14 through 16, I personally think it's even clearer. "For he himself is our peace," that is Christ, "who has made both one," Jew and Gentile, "and has broken down the middle wall of separation, having abolished in his flesh the enmity, that is, the law of commandments contained in ordinances, so as to create in himself one new man from the two. Are you following what he's saying? He's saying that Jew and Gentile were separated by the law. The law had been given to the Jews, and it made them distinct from all the other peoples of the world. It created, in a sense, an enmity between the two. He says the law of commandments contained in ordinances, but Jesus came and took that law out of the way so that he could create one new man in Jesus Christ from the two, Jew and Gentile, thus making peace, and that he might reconcile them both to God in one body through the cross, thereby putting to death the enmity. He put to death the enmity because he removed that which was the cause of the enmity, the middle wall of separation, the law of commandments contained in ordinances. And so the second point we want to make is that the Mosaic law was taken out of the way. If we're going to argue that it was used, instrumental music was used in worship in Old Testament times, we need to acknowledge that that was a different covenant. We're not living under that covenant. Now, the interesting thing about that argument is that today, if you talk to people, a lot of religious groups will just affirm very vehemently that we are still living under the Ten Commandments, and they'll choose certain other things that are certain features or regulations of the old law, and they kind of apply some and don't apply others. There were a lot of other practices that were either allowed or commanded under the law of Moses. They used incense in worship. Some churches do, but a lot of churches do not. Why not? Did it under the old law. They had a separate priesthood. Again, some churches do, but many churches do not. They had special garments for the priests. They circumcised their male infants for religious purposes. Most churches don't do that or teach that. Animal sacrifices. How many churches do you know sacrifice animals, lambs, goats, bulls, doves, in worship to God? They don't want that part of the old law. They want to be able to choose other parts of the old law. And of course, instrumental music is one of the parts that they really do want to choose. I'll tell you something else about the old law. God said to his people, I want you to destroy completely some unrighteous nations, the Amalekites, for instance, in 1 Samuel, the 15th chapter. And when they came into the land of Canaan, God said, you just clean those people out. Don't make any covenants with them. Don't marry with them. Should we do that too? Should we follow that aspect of the old law? All of us need to be at war with everybody who we don't see to be as the people of God. That's part of the old law. The key principle that we're getting at here is that the fact that some practice was authorized by the Mosaic law doesn't mean that God wants his people to do the same thing now. And the reason is we live under a different covenant. God doesn't intend for us to live, incidentally, under both the Mosaic law and the law of Christ. I've not found very many people who want to exclusively go back to the Mosaic law. What they usually want to do is much what the Galatians want to do. They want to take parts of the old law and kind of mix it with the new law and form some sort of a combination of the two. But the Apostle Paul says in Romans 7, verses 1 through 4, that when you do that, you commit spiritual adultery. And that's why he concludes then, just a couple verses later in verse 6 in Romans 7, that they had been delivered from the law. They were only able to be joined to one law at a time, much like a woman can only be joined to one husband at a time, or she becomes an adulteress. People who are trying to live under both the Mosaic law and the law of Christ are spiritual adulterers. That's the point of Paul in Romans 7. And to the Galatians, he's even more blunt. To wish to be justified before God on the basis of the Mosaic law is to sever ourselves from Christ, because the law of Moses was a law system. And the only way you could be justified under that system was to keep it perfectly. If you keep it perfectly, you don't need Jesus Christ. You don't need a sacrifice. You do it on your own merit, your own perfection. So if you want to be justified on the basis of the Mosaic law, then you fall from grace. You're fallen from grace. You're severed from Christ. You can't have it both ways. That's basically what Paul is saying. So, to the argument that instrumental music was used in worship in Old Testament times, we have to respond. The Mosaic law has been taken out of the way. It wasn't given to people, all people in general, and it has been taken out of the way. And furthermore, God didn't intend for us to mount the the law of Christ on top of the Mosaic law and combine the two, as he says to the Romans and to the Galatians. What's the ultimate answer here? And here it is in Hebrews 1. The Hebrew writer, whoever that is, says, God, who at various times and in various ways spoke in times past to the fathers by the prophets, has in these last days spoken to us by His Son. Spoke by the prophets in the past, He speaks to us by His Son. Or if you please, in Matthew the 17th chapter, on the Mount of Transfiguration, Peter, James, and John heard the voice from heaven, and the voice said, while Jesus is talking to Moses, the lawgiver, and Elijah the prophet, the voice says, this is my beloved Son, in whom I'm well pleased. Hear Him. And so the real issue here is that we need to be getting our authority from the Son, from the new covenant, not from the old covenant. Well, that's one argument. Let's look at another one. How about this one? It's in the Greek. That's kind of an intimidating argument. How many of you speak Greek? How many of you write Greek? How many of you read Greek? How many of you know a Greek, any Greek? How many of you like Greek pizza? Okay, we got a few. We got a few. But we had to come all the way down to the pizza level before we really can start relating to Greek. And so this becomes kind of an argument that's a little intimidating because, after all, we're unfamiliar with the language. If someone says, well, you know, it's in the Greek, you know, what do you, how do you argue, how do you defend that? Well, the argument basically is that the Greek word psalo, which is translated variously in the New Testament, means to accompany singing with instrumental music. And so all we have to do is find a use of that Greek word psalo, which is a verb, incidentally. All we have to do is find a use of that word in the New Testament, and what we've got then is authority to use an instrument in worship, because that's the argument that's being made. This word means to accompany singing with instrumental music. So really what we need to do is we need to talk about that word and at least define it, even if we are not real familiar with the Greek language, at least we can say something about what this word means. This word, incidentally, is used in Ephesians 5:19, and it is translated in that text, not singing. That's a different word. It's translated making melody. Now, that's not to say that psalo, that Greek word, is not translated singing in other places, but this is the passage that people like, because here, it's not translated singing, it's translated making melody. Well, now, that raises the interesting question, is this a legitimate argument then? Are we supposed to be making melody on some sort of instrument, some piano or trumpet or whatever? Well, when we look at the word psalo from the standpoint of its meanings and derivation, the truth of the matter is that this word originally did mean to play an instrument. But what we need to remember is that words can change their meaning over time, and this is a good example of one that has. I would give you an example in the English language. One that I've always enjoyed. If I were to say to you, you know, you make a fine idiot, would that offend you? Would that bother you? If I said to Ben, Ben, you're just a fine idiot, all the other young people are going, We agree with that. Now, wait a second. Our word idiot now refers to somebody's intelligence. But the word idiot, at least in the past, the distant past, Ben, formerly meant a private citizen as opposed to an office holder. So all I'm saying, Ben, is that you're a good citizen. No reflection on his intelligence. Well, the problem is that if we use words in one context or time with a meaning that actually they don't have anymore, but that actually was used or applied in a different time, then we come up with misunderstandings, like me calling Ben a good idiot and people thinking that I'm dissing him from the pulpit, which I would never do. Same thing happened with this word psalo. At one time, it did mean to play an instrument. In fact, listen to some or look at some definitions. And the interesting thing about this is, you know, we don't need to try to make the argument fit so that we can come to a specific conclusion. Just let the things speak for themselves. Let the people who use these words or define these words, let them describe it. Thayer says that this word could mean to pluck off or to pull out. It means, it meant at one time to cause to vibrate by touching, to twang, to touch or strike the chord, to twang the strings of a musical instrument so that they gently vibrate. And then, of course, with an applied meaning, to play on a stringed instrument, like to play the harp, as used in the Septuagint. Now, I made this note here because I want you to understand the Septuagint was translated. Does anybody know how long it was translated before the New Testament time period? 250 to 280 years prior to the New Testament period, prior to the time of Jesus. The Septuagint is a Greek translation of the Old Testament Hebrew Scriptures. Translation from Hebrew into Greek. At that time, 250 to 280 years prior to Christ, this word was used to talk about playing on an instrument, string instrument, to play a harp, etc. Now listen, this is Thayer's comment. He says, in the New Testament, so now he's telling you what the word means later, in the time that we're interested in the New Testament, Thayer says it means to sing a hymn, to celebrate the praises of God in song. Now let me tell you something. Thayer wasn't a member of the Church of Christ, as near as I know. Joseph Thayer was a denominational individual. Joseph Thayer is not making my argument for me. He's telling you how the word was used in New Testament times. And what he says is that by New Testament times, it didn't mean to play anymore. It meant to sing a hymn. Notice he doesn't talk to any, he doesn't say anything about playing an instrument here when we're talking about in the New Testament. See, that's a different time period. Well, let's consult a couple others, or at least one other. Artin Gingrich, another Greek lexicon, that's basically just a definition of Greek words. And these two scholars say that in our literature, in accordance with Old Testament usage, sing praise with the dative of the one for whom the praise is intended. The original meaning of solo was pluck, play, as in play a stringed instrument. And that persisted at least to the time of Lucian. In the Septuagint, this is the symbol for the Septuagint, means 70. Solo, that verb, frequently means sing, whether to the accompaniment of a harp or, as usually not, this process continued until solo in modern Greek means sing exclusively. So all Artin Gingrich are saying is that it went from play or often play to the point where now it means exclusively sing. We're looking at that time period in between there. We're not looking at the Old Testament period, the Septuagint period. We're looking at the New Testament period. He says the process continued until solo in modern Greek means sing exclusively with no reference to instrumental accompaniment. Now remember the argument. What's the argument? That if the word solo is used, it implies an instrument, that the meaning of the word includes an instrument. And Thayer says, no, it doesn't. Artin Gingrich say, no, it doesn't. And you know what? I could put a whole bunch of others up here if we wanted to spend the time. These are just representative samples. The point is, the argument is invalid. It doesn't observe this truth, and that is that words change their meaning sometimes over time. And solo is one of those words. Now, the basic meaning of solo, as we saw with Thayer, is to touch or to pluck. Now, I want to go back to Ephesians 5 and verse 19. And let's look at the passage again. Speaking to one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing, and here's what else we're doing, making melody. Where's the melody, though? Is it on a piano? What's the instrument that we pluck? This is the word psalo, making melody. That's the translation of it. Where's the instrument here, if there is an instrument? What is it that we're plucking? Well, it's our heart. At the same time that we're singing, we're not just mouthing. You know, I sing sometimes. I don't sing well, but I sing sometimes country songs. I sing other songs that I know. But I'm not making melody in my heart to the Lord. I'm singing some other song, some other verse that has no significance for worship. But when I sing hymns, psalms, spiritual songs, I'm both singing and I'm also making melody in my heart. Worship involves the heart. We made that point many times. In my heart to the Lord. And so Paul actually specifies what it is that we're doing when we're pasaloing it. Now, here's something interesting, though. Sometimes when people make an argument, they're not willing to accept the full consequence of their argument. Because you see, Ephesians 5:19 is a command, speaking to one another. And so, this is what we... Who's supposed to do this? Well, that'd be you. Be me. Be all Christians, wouldn't it? Paul's not writing to the Ephesians just for their information, but this is what we need to be doing. How many of us? Does Tara get off? But Cheryl has to? Gary gets off, but Robert has to? Or is this passage addressed to all of us? And if this word, psalo, translated making melody, means to play with an instrument, then guess what? You better get your instruments tuned up. Because every one of us is responsible for playing. Now that's not typically what's done, is it? Usually what happens is there are one or two people that are playing, or maybe a band if you really can afford it. So you have a band up in the front, you got a few people playing, what's everybody else doing? They may be singing, or they may just be listening, but they're not all obeying this command. And yet my understanding is this is addressed to all of us. This is what we all should be doing. We would see that even clearer if we expanded this verse to take in the greater context. But that's the argument that I would suggest to you, is that this argument, that is, that making melody, translating psalo, implies an instrument, means that all of us need to play, not just some of us, because the command is addressed to all of us. Well, I digress or slow down a little bit here. Let's talk about another argument, the last one. Instrumental music is an aid to our singing. Let me read to you what Webster says is the meaning of the word music. I know this seems a little simplistic, but bear with me. I'll make the point here in just a moment. Webster says, and I'm going to give you two definitions. He says that music is, one definition is that it is the science or art of ordering tones or sounds in succession, in combination, and in temporal relationship to one to produce a composition having unity and continuity. That's kind of a long definition, but what he basically is saying is that music is the art of putting together sounds or tones in some sort of organization. Well, that's understandable. He says, secondly, that music means vocal, instrumental, or mechanical sounds having rhythm, melody, or harmony. That definition may be a little too specific for some of the music that young people listen to. Because some of that music doesn't have much harmony in it. But nevertheless, I digress. The point is that Webster says it can be vocal sounds, instrumental sounds, or mechanical sounds. How many of you have heard that, I think it's an Allstate commercial, where "We Will Rock You," and you hear that beat being, you know that song, "We Will Rock You," they're singing it at all the football games, and you hear the beat, somebody's beating on something, and then the announcer comes on, the commercial guy, and he says, "Little Johnny's practicing the drums on your hood, on the hood of your car, for 3 hours. We will rock you." So he's just using your car as an instrument. He's making sounds, he's beating the sounds out. That is what? Well, it's a mechanical sound in this case. But you see that Webster says that it is the producing of sounds that can be produced either vocally by my voice or by an instrument like a trumpet or a drum or something, or some other mechanical means of making those sounds. Well, I say that because we need to understand that when God gave us instructions about music, He was specific about what kind of sounds He wanted. He said we need to be singing. That's vocal sounds. But someone says, well, but we are making vocal sounds. Our instrumental music is just to help us with those vocal sounds, our singing. Well, let me make these observations. If we're going to describe anything as an aid, and do we use aids in our singing? Yeah, somebody hold up one of the aids. Yeah, our songbooks are aids. They help us with the words, to remember the words of the songs that we're singing so that we all sing together. And they even have notes so that we kind of sound like we're singing together on most occasions, okay? And some people even use a pitch pipe to pitch the song at the beginning. But I want to ask you a question. How many of you have observed ever in your life somebody leading the singing and playing the song with a pitch pipe? Ever seen that? I've never seen it. I've never seen it. Now, maybe you have. But it seems to me that the pitch pipe gets put down before the singing ever starts. All the pitch pipe does is get you at the right sound to start the song. The function of an aid is to help one fulfill what really is already a scriptural obligation, that is, what's already authorized. An aid doesn't constitute another act. If we use books, are we now creating instrumental music by the use of a book? Or are we simply aiding still our vocal music? Well, the answer is obvious. Same thing with the pitch pipe. Does the pitch pipe involve instrumental music? Someone says, well, it is an instrument and he is pitching. He's blowing a tune on it. He's blowing a note on it. Really? Is that his worship? Is that what he's doing? He's worshiping God with the pitch pipe? Or is it aiding the singing of his song? And the pitch pipe gets put away before he ever starts singing. An aid doesn't change the basic nature of that which it is aiding. The book doesn't turn singing into instrumental music, a different kind of music. Pitch pipe doesn't change singing into a different kind of music. And neither would, if we were to put the words of the song up on the screen, that some churches are doing that. So does the use of a mechanical piece of equipment that is a projector, does it turn this then into some sort of different kind of music? No, it's still singing, isn't it? Each of these things aid the singing, but the music always stays the same. The aid doesn't change the nature of what we're doing. Now, the reason that's important is that if we wanted to talk about its application to music, and I've actually got one more chart. I'm going to make this quick because I'm running out of time. The command, go into all the world and preach the gospel. Are there any things, that's kind of general. Does the command of the Great Commission, does it specify just exactly how we're supposed to go? Well, no, it doesn't. Could we use an automobile? If we used an automobile, would that aid us in fulfilling this obligation to go and preach the gospel? Well, sure, it would. We could use other forms of transportation as long as whatever the aid is doesn't change the nature of what we're trying to do, because that's the point. What's been authorized? Here's what Jesus authorized. Go into the world and preach the gospel. As long as whatever our aid is not changing that action, we're still going, then it's simply an aid. It's not an introduction of some other kind of behavior. So what does that have to do with instrumental music? You know, there are some versions that in Ephesians 5:19 use this phrase. They translate it this way. Make music. Well, what are your options? If Paul's command is, make music, then don't you have a choice? Because there are different kinds of music, right? There's vocal music, there's instrumental music. You can bang on the hood of the car for 3 hours if you want. Make music. You could choose, because all of those would be included. You would still be making music if you played on the piano. You'd still be making music if you sang hymns and songs, spiritual songs, and psalms. But that's not an accurate translation. What Paul said was that we're to sing. That's what we're commanded to do. And the command to sing allows us less flexibility. Because you see, if you're playing, that's a different kind of music. That's instrumental music. The sounds are produced by an instrument, not by your vocal cords, which is what singing is about. Vocal music is what God commanded. Instrumental music is another type of music. And so instrumental music's not an aid, it is an additional kind of music. And that's not been authorized. How many of you are willing to give me an extra 10 minutes? Okay. All of you who didn't raise your hand, you can go ahead and stand up and silently file to the back. That's dirty, isn't it? Well, if you'll permit me, what I would like to do is spend just a very short period of time making a quick point. I won't even go through all the quotes. I'll just simply let you see what they are, and then you can certainly get a hold of them if you'd like. I'll provide them to you. But remember, we asked the question, if the scriptures don't authorize instrumental music, then why is it that we have all these churches that are using instrumental music? How could all these religious people be so far off if this is something that God's really concerned about, if it is something that is unauthorized? Well, the fact of the matter is, the Jews use instrumental music in their worship, even as the Gentiles did in their idol worship, but the early church fathers consistently wrote that the church then practiced congregational singing. Let me say this, and I'll be glad to defend this to anybody that wants to question it here or anywhere else. You will not find historical records of the early church using instrumental music. People would love to find it, but it's not there. It's not in the scriptures. It's not in other religious literature. It's pretty much, it's accepted across the board by church historians that instrumental music didn't come about until much later. The organ is said to have been first, according to Chambers Encyclopedia, introduced into church music by Pope Vitalian I in 666. That's unfortunate. In 757, a great organ was sent as a present to the King of the Franks by the Byzantine Emperor Constantine Copronymus and placed in the church. My point is, that's 757 years. That's over 700 years after the death of Jesus Christ. And that's when instrumental music is starting to be introduced into the churches. It wasn't there before. And the fact of the matter is, it's still not used in some churches that were originally affiliated with or part of the Roman Catholic Church, the Greek Orthodox Church, for instance. So, why is it that so many of the denominations use instrumental music now? The reason is it slowly crept in over time because people decided it really wasn't important whether you played or sang or did both. Debbie and I had the opportunity to go to the Mennonite Information Center when we were up in Pennsylvania, in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. They have a life-size model of the tabernacle up there, and we went through the tabernacle. But before we could go in, I had some time to kill, so I went through, read their entire exhibit, and I found something very interesting. Did you know that the Mennonites are known for a cappella music? No instrumental music, singing. And I thought, well, there you go. These people, you know, among some other things, they're following them. And then I ran into this plaque that said, they're known for their good a cappella singing, but the instrument is slowly being increased in use or something that affect in congregations. No comment on whether it was right or wrong, good or desirable, just the observation that things, they are a-changing. Even the Mennonites, who are not known for changing, like the Amish, are slowly allowing instrumental music to become a part of their worship. For a long, long time, it was not that way. And I want you to know that some of the same churches today that would defend tooth and nail their right to use an instrument, a piano or whatever, in their worship, the founders of those groups would not have had it. They'd have fought against it, in fact, did. John Calvin, who was essentially the founder of the Presbyterian Church, many things you wouldn't agree with him about, but he made the observation that musical instruments in celebrating the praises of God would be no more suitable than the burning of incense, the lighting up of lamps, and the restoration of other shadows of the law. He says the Catholics borrowed that from the Old Testament. He was against this. Others that we could point to. John Wesley. John Wesley is a founder, at least one of the founders of the Methodist group that came out of the Reformation period, came out of the Church of England. And his comment about instrumental music, he says, I have no objection to instruments of music in our chapels, provided they're neither heard nor seen. If you put them back in the storage room and nobody ever plays them, it's okay. You can have them in the chapels. What's he saying? You know, you can go to almost any Methodist church now and they will be playing an instrument. But the guy who was partly the founder of that religious denomination, he wouldn't permit it. But you see, they've drifted, and now they're doing what even those who founded that group would not have allowed. And we could just go on. Same thing with a fellow by the name of Benedict, who is a Baptist historian, and he makes the observation that in the beginning, the Baptists, they were originally Anabaptists, then later on known as Baptists, they didn't use instruments of music. And you know what? They were right about that. Or were they? What I do know is if they were right before, they're wrong now. Right? If they were right before when they were unwilling to use instruments of music and they're using them now, then they're wrong now, aren't they? They've allowed change to creep in. And brethren, that's really what we need to be careful about, because I'm telling you that the pressure is on a lot of churches of Christ. There are people who are saying, hey, you know, this is not a big deal. Let's just go ahead and use instrumental music. We'll draw more people. People like instrumental music. A lot of folks do. But what's the real issue? It's not how many people are using it. It's not whether we like it or don't like it. It's not whether we have money or don't have money or have someone who can play the piano. The issue is it authorized? And I want to show you something. Actually, I'm going to skip this chart. I've already used my time, so let me just go to this chart. Here's the argument that you won't find. When people are trying to defend instrumental music, here's the argument that you never hear. A direct statement in the New Testament showing where the church was to use instrumental music. Paul said, and I want you to play. Can't find it. It's not there. Well, that'd be simple, wouldn't it? If it was there, don't you think people would be using it in defense of instrumental music? It's not there. Or how about an example where one of the apostles or others inspired individuals, they were with a church and they were using instrumental music. Do we have a clear example, an approved example of the church using it? It's not there. How about the passage where it's just absolutely inescapable, the conclusion that the church was using instrumental music? It's not there. It's not there. Are we so arrogant to think that first century disciples were so backward that they didn't know how to play instruments? That they couldn't find instruments to play, and so they just practiced singing, they just used vocal music because that's all they could do? Are we so arrogant to think that we're so advanced, we're just more sophisticated than they are? Why is it that none of these things can be found? And church historians say it was 700 years before churches started using instruments of music, instrumental music in their worship. Instrumental music and worship. Is it important? Ask Cain whether it's important what kind of worship you use, you offer. Ask Nadab and Abihu whether it's important that you follow the instructions of God. Is it important that we follow God's instructions when we're trying to honor Him? Well, of course it is. And it is equally important when we're talking about the matter of obtaining salvation, of being forgiven of our sins. All kinds of religious groups will tell you all kinds of things. But we just go right back to the same issue, and that is, what does the book say? And the Apostle Peter told people on the day of Pentecost who had been convinced that they were guilty sinners, that they had in fact crucified Jesus, the Son of God. They believed in Him as the Son of God, and they asked Peter and the other apostles, men and brethren, what shall we do? And he told them, repent and let every one of you be baptized in the name of Jesus Christ for the remission of your sins, and you'll receive the gift of the Holy Spirit. That's what the book says. And the only question now is, have you done that? If you haven't obeyed the gospel, we certainly want to give you the opportunity this evening. We invite you, we encourage you, as we stand and sing, to give your heart to Jesus in your obedience to the gospel.